pal in South Carolina. Our daughter lives in France, and we were planning to go visit a couple of times here shortly. And if air travel is restricted, that will torpedo our plans.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. The Omicron variant is now in at least a third of U.S. states.
Clearly, it is becoming the dominant variant in South Africa. The question for us here in the United States, now that it is clearly here in at least 15 or more states and in about 40 countries, is what is it going to be as it competes with a very dominant variant, Delta?
That was President Biden's chief medical advisor, Anthony Fauci, in an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper. As U.S. officials scramble to deal with Omicron, they've introduced a wave of new travel restrictions. The bans target 8 countries in Africa. Countries in Europe and Asia have made similar restrictions. The World Health Organization is also urging those 60 and over and other vulnerable groups to avoid travel altogether. And last week, President Biden announced new testing requirements for international travelers entering the U.S.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Wyzant. Need a smarter way to learn anything? Wyzant is the nation's biggest network of professional tutors, connecting you with experts in more than 12,000 topics for personalized one-on-one lessons. On Wyzant, you choose how much to pay, who you work with, and when you meet, in person or online. NPR listeners can experience the difference personalized tutoring makes this back-to-school season by taking $25 off each of your first 3 lessons. Head to WYZANT.com/NPR today to start learning.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Here to discuss what travel under Omicron will look like, we have Dr. Saad Omer, inaugural director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Dr. Omer, welcome.
My pleasure.
We also have with us Dr. Celine Gounder. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at the New York University School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital Center. She's also a former member of the President's COVID-19 Task Force. Dr. Gounder, welcome back to the program.
Yes, it's great to be here.
Well, Omicron has been detected in at least 16 states here in the U.S. Where does the country stand right now with the new variant, Dr. Gounder?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that the Delta variant remains, at least for now, the dominant variant. We are really doing aggressive surveillance to look for Omicron. We are finding it in a number of different states across the country. Some states, however, are relative blind spots. You have some states that are sequencing, in other words, looking for Omicron in as many as 30% of all of their COVID cases, and you have other states that are only doing that in 1%. And so that really does present a blind spot where you could have spread of Omicron, and we may just not know it.
And when you talk about a variant being dominant, you said Delta is still the dominant variant in the U.S. Explain exactly what that means.
Well, what that means is over 99% of COVID cases in the United States are still related to the Delta variant. The Delta variant has not gone away. And in fact, heading into the Thanksgiving holiday, we were already experiencing a surge in the United States in cases, in hospitalizations related to the Delta variant. So the Delta variant may not be brand new anymore, but it remains a very real threat. And then on top of that, of course, we now have the emergence of Omicron, and we still have yet to fully assess what that threat is going to be.
Dr. Omer, we know at least some vaccinated people have been infected with the Omicron variant and that it's been found in people with no travel history. Explain how this variant is different from some of the others we've seen.
Well, it's too early to be definitive about the properties of this variant. But the early data seem a little bit concerning, or somewhat concerning at least. And the data have come from South Africa primarily. but from other countries as well. The South Africa data suggests, first of all, in terms of the virus itself, it seems to have a high number of mutations, and some of them may be associated with what some folks call immune escape, essentially meaning that it may have diminished effectiveness in terms of vaccines that are being used against this virus. So that's one thing. The second thing is that there has been a fairly sharp rise in cases in some parts of South Africa. Having said that, this is still early. We don't know if these, what will be the effectiveness of current vaccines against this variant definitively. And my best guess is, and with some caveat that this is perhaps an informed guess, that even if there is a diminishing of effectiveness, it's highly unlikely, particularly against severe outcomes, that there will be low effectiveness or no effectiveness of these vaccines. So there are signs for concern, but there's a lot to be sorted out. And one more thing that I would add that needs to be sorted out is what is the severity of disease this variant causes compared to other variants.
Now, you mentioned, Dr. Omer, that South African doctors announced their discovery of Omicron. Travel restrictions were quickly levied against multiple countries in Africa, but a handful of cases were later found to have been in the Netherlands for up to 2 weeks before South Africa's announcement. Can you explain what happened there?
Well, what I can tell you is that from a scientific perspective, from an epidemiologic perspective, these restrictions, especially the way they were implemented, don't make sense. And here's the reason why. So we know from previous studies, from modeling work, and from sort of these newer studies that have come out after COVID-19, that it's not that travel bans cannot work at all in all circumstances, but you need to have a restriction of travel into a country by up to 90 to 95%. On top of that, you have to start really, really early, much earlier than when this variant was identified. And so obviously this this kind of a drastic action has cost, a lot of cost. And even then, it only works when the virus has lower infectivity, or lower, what we call the basic reproduction number, much lower than what we expect this variant to have. And even then, it only works for delaying the importation of a virus into a country. And so what happened was that these travel bans were imposed mainly to South African countries, Southern African countries. We knew even on day one that they were not supported by evidence. And here's the reason why. So some folks say that, okay, maybe the aim is not to stop it altogether, but to delay it, and why not err on the side of caution? So as I alluded to the evidence earlier, that even the evidence for delaying it substantially doesn't support these kinds of just targeted bans, at this stage and with these properties, but it has a cost, and the cost is that you absolutely want to encourage reporting of new variants and new viruses in the future by all countries. And so this really disincentivizes that kind of open reporting that we need.
Dr. Gounder, I want to drill down a bit more into testing. President Biden recently announced inbound international travelers will need to test for COVID within 24 hours of departure. How effective are testing requirements in curbing transmission of the virus?
Testing is really important. And I think it's important that the administration has tightened up that window for testing. So one of the challenges with the Delta variant, and we have yet to see for sure with the Omicron variant, but maybe the same, is that the incubation period is quite short. And so people could have tested previously within 72 hours of boarding a flight, could have tested negative, but had been incubating an infection, and then by the time they boarded the flight, could have in fact been positive. And so because that incubation period, which is the time from exposure to the time of being infectious to other people, because that is such a short window, you really need to try to test as soon as possible before somebody boards a flight to reduce that risk.
We got this tweet from AM who says, we just got back from a trip to Ireland and the UK to visit family. It was nerve-wracking being away and seeing all the restrictions changing. Lots of anxiety. The cost implication of all the testing was hard to swallow and very expensive for a family of four. Dr. Omer, how much does travel impact infection rates? Do we know?
We know, broadly speaking, that travel has implications on infection spread because we are a globally connected society, in a sense that when there is a viral threat in one region, we are all under threat because of that emergence. So yes, travel impacts the spread of viruses, and including in this pandemic. But you can decrease that risk. You can mitigate some of the effects of travel. And as Dr. Gounder described, that you can have a layered protection approach to making travel safe.
We got this comment from David on Facebook who says, COVID is not going away. It's going to be here forever. I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, just stating the plain obvious facts. Get the vaccine and wear a mask. Dr. Omer, is this our new travel normal? And is there some argument to be made that this is a safer way to travel anyway?
I think this is our new transient travel normal. I do believe that eventually, one way or another, we will move towards more familiar territory, in the sense that there will be lower restrictions or requirements needed. But unfortunately, we are not there. Unfortunately, because we have been doing half-baked measures, and there have been issues with compliance of some of these recommendations, like indoor masking, like vaccination and both primary series and now booster, especially in high-risk populations, this kind of situation will be prolonged. But most experts believe that eventually this virus will become endemic. That doesn't mean that it will go away as a problem, but there will be a certain level of disease and, unfortunately, mortality that is not so high as to impact the daily functions of life. But in order to get there, we can get there through two pathways. One is developing high enough population immunity through infection. The other one is through vaccination. The first pathway means that there could be and will be, unfortunately, a lot of morbidity and death, a lot of disease and death. And the second pathway requires that all of us, not just in this country, but around the world, are vaccinated so that we can develop population immunity to an extent that even though there will still be some flare-ups of this virus, it goes away as a global problem.
When we talk about vaccination as related to travel, however, it makes me wonder about the issue of vaccine inequity and if vaccines are part of the answer to getting the pandemic under control. That vaccine equity issue has to be addressed, Dr. Omer. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened, and there is a little bit of a nuance there. What happened earlier on was in 2020 that there was a global mechanism created to supply a vaccine to pretty much everyone, but with a focus on some low and middle income countries that everyone knew that wouldn't have ready access to these vaccines and may not be able to afford them. For a while, that mechanism called COVAX was underfunded. The Trump administration, unfortunately, didn't engage with this mechanism at all, and that mechanism didn't have money to buy vaccine doses. And so when it didn't have enough money to buy vaccine doses or high amounts of them or reserve that capacity, a lot of countries, high-income countries especially, in parallel, started doing their own deals with vaccine companies. And so when the vaccine became available, these countries had hedged their bets. So they had ordered more than enough vaccine for a while. And on top of that, these, you know, COVAX and low-income countries did not have the access to those doses because they had all, the capacity had already been booked. And by the time COVAX got money and the Biden administration provided substantial amount of money, the Europeans also provided a lot of money to these countries, but also the World Bank provided these financing facility eventually. But by that time, we had the situation that high-income countries had doses reserved or delivered that were more than what their population needed. It's perfectly reasonable to hedge your bets, but there is a limit to that, especially when the success of a domestic response depends on what happens globally. In the meantime, countries who didn't have access to vaccines, especially low-income countries, could not develop their capacity to deliver them. Because if you don't know if you, whether you're getting a J&J vaccine or a Pfizer vaccine or another kind of vaccine, for example, you can't order the right amount of freezer. You can't, and if you don't know how many doses you're getting and on what schedule, you can't hire people and let them sit around. These countries do not have, you know, money to throw at this problem and just wait for the doses.
We're going to get more into vaccine distribution and equity a little later in the hour. We got this email from Bob who says, I am a Canadian citizen working in the U.S. as a green card holder. I'm triple vaccinated, but I have canceled plans to fly today from Rochester, New York to Edmonton, Alberta, because COVID testing requirements for entry to Canada are not the same as re-entry to the U.S. While Canadian COVID testing requirements were relatively clear, those for re-entry on the CDC and other websites are confusing. Dr. Gounder, how clear is the communication around U.S. travel restrictions right now?
So I think part of what's driving his concern is which test is being required. So Canada is requiring the PCR test, which I would actually argue is not the right test to be using here. We have PCR tests, which is really what you should be using if you are sick in the hospital. Doctors are trying to figure out whether to give you, whether it's monoclonal antibodies or steroids. They have to make those kinds of decisions. That's a very different kind of decision-making process than assessing whether you're infectious to other people. And so depending on the purpose of testing, different tests will be the best test. I would argue that for the purpose of saying, are you infectious to other people? Are you an infectious threat to others? The antigen tests are really much more appropriate. And this is important because the turnaround time on these tests is different. If you get a PCR test, that could take you a couple days to get your result. It doesn't matter so much that there's a lag. If it's really to inform a doctor's decision in the hospital, they might start medications, and then once they have that final result, might adjust that, might stop them. That's very different from the decision-making that you're making for a flight, for travel. You want to know at that exact point in time, is somebody infectious to other people? Not were they infectious or not 3 days ago. And the turnaround time for those rapid tests is about 15 minutes. You can do that yourself in 15 minutes. There are apps that you can use, telemedicine kinds of platforms, where somebody can observe you taking the test so that you have that result within 15 minutes for travel. But I think the problem is that lack of clarity as to which test is appropriate And the over-aggressiveness, but the inappropriate requirement for PCR testing for Canadian travel is partly what's fueling that confusion there.
We also got this email from Mary who says, I am traveling to Germany in a couple of weeks. My son tells me that my proof of vaccination has to be with a QR code. How do I get that? Dr. Gounder, I don't know if you can answer Mary's question specifically, but how do travelers deal with differing vaccine requirements country by country?
Well, you should definitely have documentation of your vaccination status, perhaps a photo of your CDC vaccination card on your phone as a backup. And then be sure to submit it to the airline, depending on the airline. Many of them have a pre-travel submission portal. And then for testing, there are a couple different platforms that you can use. One is called emed.com, emed.com, and then you have Azova, azova.com, both of which allow you to do that testing observed by somebody through your phone. And at the end of all of that, you get a QR code that you can also present for travel.
We're talking to Dr. Celine Gounder, an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at the New York University School of Medicine, and Dr. Saad Omer. He's the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. We also want to hear from you. What questions do you have about traveling under Omicron? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. Here's a message we received from one of you.
This is Hal in South Carolina. Our daughter lives in France, and we were planning to go visit a couple of times here shortly. And if air travel is restricted, that will torpedo our plans.
We also got this email from another 1A listener who writes, speaking as someone who was separated from my partner for almost a year due to travel bans, I'd like to comment on how little they did to stop spread. The toll of mental health in this already anxious environment is extremely harmful. By the time a travel ban is implemented, it's already too late. This has been proven over and over. It's time for a different strategy. Dr. Gounder, what is the emotional toll of travel restrictions? Is that something world leaders keep in mind when implementing them?
Well, I think it's very real. I mean, I've faced it myself in visiting my own family, just the restrictions around travel and lack of mobility. I think it is true that travel bans have very limited impact. Right now, as an American citizen, I could fly to South Africa a dozen times in the next month if I wanted to. I mean, that goes to show you there's very little actually restriction on the flow of the virus. And so when you're implementing travel bans only on certain people, on foreign nationals, but not on Americans, not on permanent residents, who are still free to go back and forth, the virus is still very much free to go back and forth.
Dr. Omer, and your thoughts to the other point the caller made about the idea that travel restrictions don't work and that a different strategy is needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more recent strategies that were announced, sort of increased testing, and in certain situations, countries have used quarantine, limited quarantine, for very effectively, etc. And also making travel itself safe. So, for example, masking both domestically and internationally. Remember, people who are going even internationally have connecting flights domestically. And I think it's time that we have a federal mandate for masks on planes and even on trains, hopefully as well. So that kind of a layered approach is helpful.
We got this question from Dell, who tweets, I have a hypothetical question. If the new variant outcompetes Delta, in spread, but has very mild symptoms, can this be applied as a strategy to curb pandemics sooner by creating such a virus in a lab? Dr. Gounder, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think this is very hopeful, perhaps wishful thinking. I think it's a new twist on herd immunity. I think we have to be very careful about advocating such an approach until we truly understand how virulent the Omicron variant is. So far, most of the cases have been among younger, relatively healthier people who we know tend to have milder cases of COVID. And so we really need to wait until we have better data on how Omicron performs in different demographics, different age groups, before concluding that that would, in fact, be an appropriate strategy. The other thing I just want to clarify is that the Biden administration, in fact, does mandate that travelers wear masks in airports, on planes, and other modes of public transportation like trains and buses. And in fact, they've extended that requirement through the middle of March of 2022. The challenge is that those mandates are not always enforced, but there is, in fact, a mask mandate on domestic airline travel.
We got this last question from Jean, who says, we're planning to travel from Indiana to California and back during the upcoming holiday season. How safe overall is this with respect to the pandemic? We're fully vaccinated and boosted, but we'll be passing through numerous states and staying in hotels all along the way. Your thoughts? Dr. Gowner, just about 30 seconds here. We've been focusing on air travel, but what about car travel?
Well, I think your risk is lower because you're not going to be mixing with other people as much. I would just be careful when you're indoors in public places, you continue to mask. Perhaps keep your meals to outdoors or in your own private room. But I think the key is that you've been vaccinated and that you do plan to continue masking.
We've been talking to Dr. Celine Gowner. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at the New York University School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital Center. She's also a former member of the president's COVID-19 task force. And also with us today, Dr. Saad Omer. He's the founding director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Dr. Omer, Dr. Gowner, thanks for joining us today.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Grifols. Senior Director of Corporate Affairs Vlasta Hakes explains the science behind the plasma-derived medicines the company produces.
Plasma contains proteins and antibodies. There are people who are missing those antibodies or they're missing a protein that helps their body function. And what Grifols then does is we collect this plasma and then isolate those proteins and antibodies to produce a medicine.
To learn more about donating plasma and to find a Grifols center near you, visit grifolsplasma.com.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's turn back to our conversation on the new SARS-CoV-2 Omicron variant. The emergence of Omicron has renewed scrutiny of how vaccines are being distributed globally. So let's turn now to David Miliband. He's the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, an NGO that provides humanitarian aid around the globe. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
So vaccine inequity is a problem for low-income countries globally, but particularly for countries in Africa. This is a continent of over 1.3 billion people, and they've received less than 3% of the world's vaccine doses. What accounts for that discrepancy?
Yes, just to be clear, this is a problem not just for Africa or the developing world. It's a problem for all of us, because the race between vaccines and variants is being lost in large swathes of the world, the poorest parts of the world. And as we're discovering with the Omicron variant, what starts in a poor country doesn't stay in a poor country. The explanation for this vaccine inequity has three elements. First of all, production of vaccines. For a significant amount of time, the production of vaccines was pretty slow. We're now up to 1.5 billion vaccines being produced per month. So that's good. Second problem, the redistribution of the vaccines. Essentially, richer countries are hoarding vaccines. There are hundreds of millions of excess doses in rich countries. In fact, we think that 100 million will go to waste in the next month or so. So there is a redistribution problem. And then there is, thirdly, a distribution problem. Even those poor countries that are getting some vaccines, too often they're stuck in the capital or stuck at the airport and they're not getting into arms. In other words, we're not turning vaccines into vaccinations. And so this problem of vaccine inequity is actually a threat to life and livelihood in poor countries. And we can go into some of the statistics to show just how dire is the situation. But it's also a global threat to economy and society.
So there are 54 countries on the continent of Africa, yet it's often talked about as if it's a monolith. How much variation is there in healthcare infrastructure and access from country to country?
Well, that's a very good point, that the 54 countries of Africa don't just span an enormous geography, they also span enormous differences in socioeconomic status. I mean, even within South Africa, which you mentioned, the most advanced parts of South Africa, you would be no different from the medical care or the infrastructure that you would see in parts of the United States. But obviously, there are extremely poor parts even of that country. Now, some of the poorest parts in Africa are suffering malnutrition. They're suffering from, in a country like South Sudan, the vaccination rate against COVID is just 1.1%. So it's absolutely tiny. It's a country, South Sudan, of about 11 million people. It's ravaged by war. So the continent has wealth, but it also has cheek by jowl conflict and poverty of a great kind. And this means that the distribution questions I mentioned, not just the redistribution or production questions, are especially important. Because if we are to get genuinely global vaccination, it's going to need to reach people who are hard to reach. I also think it's really important, your point, that the detection was done in South Africa. That shows that we need proper testing and what's called genomic sequencing so that wherever this virus mutates, the world can see what is the origins of it, what is the content of it, and make sure it takes the right action on the vaccination front. And there's obviously a fear that somehow the message to South Africa will be that they're being punished for reporting to the world on the variant. That's the opposite of what we need.
David, I'm curious about how SARS-CoV-2 fits into broader public health strategy in developing nations, because there are ongoing health concerns like tuberculosis, like malaria, things that are killing people every year. How does it measure up to those other concerns?
Yeah, that's a great point, because in fact, in many ways, the fight against COVID is an outlier in that it's going so badly. If you think about malaria, if you think about AIDS, if you think about TB, there have been tremendous strides in the last 20 years. People who said you can't conquer AIDS in the developing world, the people who said you can't conquer malaria, have been proved wrong. In the case of malaria, by some very basic efforts in respect of bed nets, in respect of TB and AIDS, more advanced medical interventions. But COVID is very, very peculiar in this way as a global response, because it's much more transmissible than those other diseases. So in other words, it's a global challenge, not just a local challenge. But the fight against it has been pursued in a fragmented, diluted, weak and ineffective way. And so we have completely failed to learn the real lessons of the last 20 years, which is that these global health challenges are manageable. They can be attacked in an effective way, but they need coordinated action and strong global leadership. And the truth about a pandemic is it's not just a health issue. It's a economic issue, it's a political issue, it's a social security, even national security issue. And at the moment, we don't have the global infrastructure in place to fight this battle in an effective way.
We're talking to David Miliband. He's president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. They provide humanitarian aid around the globe. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. David, focus in a bit more on the economic piece of this, especially when we're talking about travel restrictions. How do those affect poorer countries?
Well, the immediate response in South Africa is real concern about its tourist industry. But there are secondary effects which aren't perhaps immediately obvious. The critical part of South Africa's development path, and in fact the development path for the rest of Africa, is to engage with the rest of the world, not separate itself from the rest of the world. And to the extent that business travel is interrupted, to the extent that the reputation of the African continent takes a hit, that is a real drag anchor on the economic development of the continent. Never mind the impact if we end up in further lockdowns. And so I think that the South Africans deserve real praise for the way that they have sequenced and reported on this Omicron variant. But they also need real engagement and support in getting the vaccination drive up so that they have some kind of inoculation for the future.
That's David Miliband. He's president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, an organization that provides humanitarian aid around the globe. David, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Today's producer was Arfi Getty. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. We'll talk more soon. This is 1A.